This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. The man charged in Friday's shooting in Burlington appeared about an hour ago in a crowded Skagit County courtroom.
Mr. Chetton, do you understand the charges?
Yes, Your Honor.
20-year-old Darjan Chetton of Oak Harbor has admitted to investigators that he shot the five people in the Macy's in Burlington's Cascade Mall. He was charged today with five counts of first-degree murder, each count carrying a possible sentence of life in prison. He's being held on $2 million bail. For about 24 hours after the first police report came in Friday night in Burlington, police searched for the shooting. KUOW's Carolyn Edoff tells us how that search unfolded.
Friday night past 6 o'clock, just north of Mount Vernon, security cameras record a young man inside a mall carrying a long gun. There are reports of gunfire. The young man walks away and a manhunt is on. The next morning, police appear to have little information as the death toll grows to five. Mount Vernon Police Lieutenant Chris Kamick.
The surest thing I have right now is just from the security camera footage from inside the store.
But other footage reveals details about a car, which leads to information about its driver, leading to this moment on Saturday in late afternoon. Lieutenant Michael Hawley at his office in Oak Harbor looking at a new stream of information, including the suspect's driver's license photo.
I overheard our scanner, the Oak Harbor Police Department, had spotted the possible suspect car about half a mile south of my office. I told myself and my sergeant and one of our reserve deputies to let's get down there and help out.
That was Lieutenant Hawley speaking at a news conference late Saturday night. What Hawley didn't mention then is that he knew the face in the photo. This was Arjan Chetton, first identified by police as Arkan Satin, and Hawley had seen and spoken to him back in November. Chetton has faced criminal charges in the past, but Hawley said this encounter wasn't about any of that.
I had, actually had been with him and talked to him about some stuff.
Soon Hawley is driving through the north end of Oak Harbor, and there's the suspect, walking along the road just a few blocks from his own car, with the police officer driving toward him.
Driving by at maybe about 30 miles an hour.
Hawley is a 30-year veteran of the force. He says his reaction was so instant.
I hit my lights, jammed my brakes, did a little bat turn, and leapt from the car, drew my weapon.
And ordered him to stop. Hawley says it was all automatic.
By the time I had started thinking again, I already had my gun out on him and I was out of my car.
Hawley doesn't remember exactly what he said into the police radio, but he said officers filled the streets just a few moments later. Oak Harbor officers had been combing the area, and there were undercover detectives from Skagit County nearby. The young man they captured put up no resistance. Hawley first used the word zombie to describe him. Now, he says, Chetton spoke of being tired.
Totally exhausted. He could have been up for 24 hours straight.
About 6:30 tonight, we arrested a 20-year-old Oak Harbor man.
A manhunt that had lasted 24 hours was over. The motive for the shootings is still unknown. Five people have died. The FBI says it is assisting Skagit County's investigation, and soon there may be more information about the victims. I'm Carolyn Adolph, KUOW News.
And now here to give us the latest in this story is Seattle Times reporter Jessica Lee. Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Of course. Glad I could help.
What do we know so far about this suspect, Arjan Chetton?
Well, by talking to people who knew him, he's described as being awkward, occasionally inappropriate. One person described him as that kid who wasn't afraid to say something offensive or vulgar. As mentioned previously, court records show he has a criminal record that includes domestic violence, assault. Other than that, we're still trying to gather more about who this guy is.
Chetton has, as we said, now been charged today. What are the key questions left in this case that authorities are looking into?
Well, we still don't know motive. We don't know why this Macy's, why he went to the mall. According to these court docs that were released this morning, he was attending a dinner with his father earlier that Friday evening, and at some point they had a falling out. The suspect told his stepfather he was going to a gym, and then investigators are still trying to piece together that timeline between that falling out and the shooting.
Okay, so police are looking for a motive now. And again, this man from Oak Harbor has reportedly told the authorities that he is the shooter in this case. Jessica, how is the Burlington area community coping with this?
The main thing that I've heard is disbelief, shock. It's described as a very tight-knit community. The whole Valley region is completely speechless. They really don't understand why here and disbelief.
Seattle Times reporter Jessica Lee, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Of course. Glad I could help.
Telling us about Arjan Chetan, the man who has admitted shooting five people at the Cascade Mall in Burlington, has been charged with five counts of murder. So now people in Burlington and around Burlington figure out how they can move forward. Burlington's mayor, Steve Sexton, says every time a mass shooting happens someplace else, he would think about how his community would respond.
How would our law enforcement respond? And really, how would I respond as a mayor? Because there's really no mayor's manual for this type of thing. And it was the law enforcement response was unbelievable. The number of folks we had respond, like you said in the press conference, is 28 agencies, nearly 200 law enforcement personnel, and they worked so well together. And the briefings I got yesterday morning, it was just very complimentary. The level of professionalism, the teamwork, the efforts to get people out was unbelievable.
What have your community members been telling you?
The overall theme that I've heard from the community members is this evil act will not define us. This is not Burlington. This was the world coming to our doorstep. You know, we're coming together with love and support for each other to crowd out this evil and the evil that the world brings us and lift each other up. And I got to tell you, the support that I've felt, the prayers I've felt, the thoughts I've felt from the community have really buoyed myself, our law enforcement officials, everybody, to keep everybody strong together.
You've said that this shooting is the world knocking on our doorstep and that this is not Burlington. What do you mean by that?
Well, we like to think that we're insulated from some of the things that go on in other bigger areas, but if Burlington is not immune to this type of senseless violence, I don't know what community in our country would be. We have to be aware. We have to be vigilant, and we have to just watch out for each other, I think.
How do you think this shooting might change the city of Burlington, about 8,000 residents?
Well, you know, we've always known that it's a possibility. Our local law enforcement drills at that mall on an active shooter scenario once or twice a year. So it's not like it wasn't, you know, something we never even considered. But going forward, I think it's just relying on each other, lifting each other up, still having the relationships and the closeness that this community has always felt, that bond cannot be broken. And I don't think it will be broken, honestly.
You've used the word evil. The day after the shooting, you vowed to help law enforcement, quote, bring this son of a bitch to justice. Now that this man, 20-year-old Arjan Chetan, you know who he is, he's in custody, do you feel any differently about him?
No, and in fact, I'd like to correct you. I wouldn't phrase anyone who takes the lives of four innocent women and an innocent man for doing nothing more than stopping by a shopping mall on a Friday evening. I would never term that person a man.
Are you to the point yet, Mayor, where you're even thinking about how to prevent shootings like this?
Well, it's, I don't know. We, of course, we'll have a lot of debriefings and after action reports and those type of things on what could have been done. I'd love to say that there was something that if we could have done this one thing, it could have prevented this. But when you look at our society, you know, we are a free and open society. And with that comes some that with that openness, we aren't always as protected as we could be. I think it's up to each individual to do what they feel is necessary to keep themselves as safe and secure as they possibly can.
Sounds like you're not getting involved in any arguments about mental health or gun control.
Well, the mental health piece is something that, you know, that's a bigger discussion for another day. Gun control, again, that's a different discussion for another day also, I think. You know, I have my own personal beliefs on that, but this is not an appropriate time for me to express those, to be honest with you. I think each of us need to do what we need to do to feel comfortable and safe in society. And I take those levels of precaution for myself and my family, and I'll leave that for everybody else to determine for themselves. I want to say this, though, if I can. You know, there's a lot of discussions in our society about police and their motives and their thoughts and things like that. If there's anyone in your listening audience who has a doubt about the level of commitment and service our law enforcement officers, men and women, provide us on a daily basis, they can feel free to contact me at the Burlington City Hall, and I'll have a chat about what that first response looks like. When those men and women were racing into an active shooter scenario to help bring people out, people they most likely had never met, did not know their nationality, their race, the color of their skin, their religion. All they knew is, I have to get there as fast as I can to do whatever I can to help save these people. That was a phenomenal thing for me to witness.
Mayor, how do you begin to rebuild now? What do you do next?
We have community gatherings. We have a community candlelight vigil this evening at 7 p.m. at the mall parking lot. And I expect a huge turnout. We take time. We pray for the families who lost loved ones. We do what we can to help support them and lift them up in our community. My favorite espresso stand has their sign, and it says, we hug tight and we love big. And that's how we're going to, you know, start to repair our little community here.
That is the mayor of Burlington, Steve Sexton. His town is the 7th community in Washington State to experience a mass shooting this year. Tonight at 7 o'clock, there's a vigil at the Cascade Mall in the parking lot. It's been organized by several churches in the area. By the way, in Houston, Texas this morning, a man shot 6 people at a strip mall before police shot and killed him. Police say the gunman was a lawyer who lived in the neighborhood and was having problems with his law firm. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. You know, you don't have to be alone tonight. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton will have their first presidential debate in about 6 hours, and you should come watch it with us at Naked City Brewery in Greenwood. KUOW and Humanities Washington are hosting this debate-watching party. Our executive producer of community engagement is Ross Reynolds. Hey, Ross.
How you doing, Bill?
This is what you do. You and your team put on public events where our listeners can engage with us, engage with each other. I want to know what you were thinking as you planned this particular event.
Well, you know, Bill, we did a bunch of events around the caucuses. We call them un-caucuses. We had a couple of events on the east side with Republicans talking about their reaction to Donald Trump. This time, we're going to let the event be the actual thing that goes on. So many people are going to be watching this debate. There's a lot of speculation about what will happen. We don't know what's going to happen. So we're just going to let it be and have a less serious event with drinking games and bingo.
Drinking games and bingo. How's it going to go tonight?
Well, here's a few things we'll be trying out. If there's a personal insult between the two candidates, bing, a bell will go off. You'll have to take a drink. If the wall on the Mexican border is mentioned, bing, you'll have to take a drink. If the candidates talk over each other, bing, you'll have to take a drink. And we'll also have some bingo cards we're handing out that mention a bunch of things we expect will happen. And whoever, you know, gets the bingo, they're going to win some KUOW swag.
And hopefully some Ubers to take people home afterwards.
Exactly.
Okay, so I wonder about the vibe, you know, presidential debate drinking game. So how did you decide what you wanted to go after here?
Well, we decided that there's so much tension going on over this election. You see it everywhere. A lot of nervousness going on, I think, on both sides about what this is going to mean. And rather than try to kind of capitalize on that, we thought, well, let's be a little bit lighthearted about this. In some ways, this is like a sporting event and that we're all going to be spectators to see these two people clashing. Will a lot of firm policy information come out about this? I don't necessarily think so. So we're kind of going for the spectacle here.
And I wonder what's going to happen during commercials, after the debate. Are you going to have any guidance for people, or kind of just let them react hot?
We're just going to watch to see how they react. The purpose of this is kind of just for us to be together so you're not sitting home alone, drinking alone. God forbid you should do that. Come out with us and join us, and we'll see what happens.
I know all are welcome, of course. Are you prepared for partisanship and squabbles at Naked City Brewery?
You know, within the limits of civility, we would encourage it. But frankly, it's a North Seattle event, and I would be surprised if we had a lot of political diversity, but we shall see.
Now, as you sort of referred to, some people are truly worried about the debate. And we also associate KOW with in-depth analysis. We're making it clear this is a chance to see it as it unfolds in real time and maybe be neighborly about it.
Absolutely. And ideally talk about it. I'm sure we'll have a lot of conversations that are going on while there are commercials and other things. But the main idea is for us to be together to talk about this. Let's let the networks and others do the analysis. There'll be plenty of that after the debate is over and tomorrow morning. Tonight, we're just going to watch it together and see what we see.
Do you know whether this is going to happen for the other debates as well?
Yes, it is. We're going to do this for all three debates at Naked City. So if you get late to this one or you can't make it to tonight's, we hope to see you in the future.
And it might be jammed, so get at it. Well, early, before, like a half hour before the debate starts?
I would totally say that. Yeah, try to get there by 5:30. We're expecting a big crowd this evening.
At Naked City Brewery in the Greenwood neighborhood, 8564 Greenwood, KOW's Ross Reynolds. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, see you there.
Yeah, should be fascinating. KOW in Humanities Washington, Zeki Barak Hamid is also going to be there. You play games, win trivia prizes. You can find out more at KOW.org/engage. Now, I'd like to know, because there's been a lot of focus on the moderator, the role of the moderator. Will there be fact-checking? Will there be challenging? What if there's arguments breaking out? What question do you, listener, do you want the moderator, Lester Holt, to ask the candidates? Let us know on Twitter right now, and we'll get back with you with some of our favorite answers. So we want a question that maybe gets to the heart of things, maybe the question in your fever dream you wish the moderator would ask. So finally, on debates, you can have a beer with us at Naked City Brewery. You could also hit the hard stuff. We found out a couple of local bars that are offering special cocktails for your debate-watching pleasure or pain, either way. The Blue Water Bistro in Leschi has mixed up two drinks. There's the Hillerita. That's a blue Patron margarita with blue curacao. And also they're offering the Trump Tower. Huge and amazing, but we don't know what's in it yet. And also the diner and bar Lost Lake on Capitol Hill for Clinton. Their drink is the I'm with Herb. Get it? I'm with Herb. I'm with her. It's good. It's better in print. But I'm with Herb. It has vodka, pink lemonade, basil, and mint. And finally, the Lost Lake is also offering up the Trump Slide, a decadent mix of vodka, Kahlua, and Bailey's Irish Cream, perfect for sipping during a hot debate. This frozen cocktail is rich, nasty, sweet, and very, very cold. Enjoy the debates. Hope you'll come watch it with us at Naked City Brewery and analyze it with us tomorrow here on KUOW Seattle. It's The Record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Seattle Public Schools flipped the bell times this year to let teenagers sleep in and have young kids start earlier. A group of parents and teachers and sleep experts have been calling for these changes for years. Now KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld finds out how the new times are working.
The days start slowly at Angie LaFave's home. She's both the alarm clock and the snooze button for her 7-year-old son, Owen.
Hey, bud. Can you wake up, honey?
I am.
You're slowly waking up? Okay. Good job, bud.
Owen is not a morning person, so the new early start time at his elementary school is tough.
It's really hard because I wish that I could sleep in the 9.
In the old system, most middle and high schools started at 7:50. Elementary schools started as late as 9:30. Now those start times are switched. Sleep experts say that makes sense because most young kids' peak learning hours are early in the morning. Teens need a later start because their biological clocks make it hard to fall asleep before 11 p.m. But the new times have meant difficult changes for some family routines, like moving around childcare and having time for sports practices and after-school jobs. Overall, though, the changes appear to be working.
I've noticed that the mornings are a lot less stressful.
Kira Hoffman is an eighth grader at Jane Addams Middle School. She says getting to sleep in lets her focus more easily in her first period class.
Like, I don't feel super rushed or worried about, like, how much I've slept or when I'm going to get to school or if I'm going to be late.
Dr. Maida Chen has been a big proponent of Seattle School's bell time change. She directs the Pediatric Sleep Disorder Center at Seattle Children's.
I would hope to see that for our older children, so our teenagers and our tweeners, that really we'll start to see less what I call weekend binge sleeping. The reason that becomes important is because that really is a sign that their sleep is regulating and they're getting more adequate sleep throughout the week.
Good day, sunshine.
At Whittier Elementary, performing arts teacher Steph Turner says it used to be hard to keep students on task in the afternoon.
Last year, it feels like the end of the day, they were so tired. But I feel like now, with the earlier start time, they have a lot more energy in a good way. But I've definitely seen a change in just overall attention.
Turner is also the mom of two elementary schoolers and says they're adapting to the earlier start.
It's pretty early for the teachers, but I think the teachers are having the hardest time getting up that early. My own two children seem to be doing pretty okay.
Sleep doctor Maida Chen says parents in her practice are becoming more aware of how bell times can affect child sleep habits.
Interestingly, I've already begun to see other school districts that have not changed their school start times with families coming in and saying, hey, how come our kids aren't getting this? And hopefully that level of advocacy across the board will continue to rise.
That advocacy is underway again in Seattle. That's because about 15% of elementary schools did not get the early start times. That allowed the district to keep the same number of school buses and avoid spending money on the change. A group of late start parents is now challenging that decision. I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
And there's a lot of conversation about this topic right now on KUOW's Facebook page. I would like to know from you, parents, how is it going? How has the school change affected your child's schedule, your schedule? How are you managing this, and how's it going so far, the Seattle school time changes? Let us know at KUOW's Facebook page. You're with The Record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. More than 1,500 patients with chronic pain have turned to emergency rooms for treatment. That's because back in July, the Seattle Pain Center suddenly closed. The clinic had 8 locations around the state. All of its former patients were left with limited options for pain treatment. Seattle Times reporter Jonelle Alicia says the Seattle Pain Center's medical director, Dr. Frank Lee, was stripped of his medical license for practices that state regulators said possibly contributed to the deaths of some of his patients.
State investigators found that he had been not properly monitoring many of his patients, and in July, they discovered that he had possibly been linked to 18 deaths, possibly more, of Medicaid patients who were served by his clinics.
So the fallout from the closing of the Seattle Pain Center clinics is that there are, as you report, more than 1,500 patients looking for care in emergency rooms.
Yeah, you know, actually, there are about 8,000 patients who are actively getting opioids from Seattle Pain Centers, and as many as 25,000 patients served by his clinics during the time that he was operating. These 1,500 are only those who have showed up in emergency rooms in kind of this acute phase after the centers were closed in mid-July.
So bigger picture, we've got a mix of people without the place they're used to going to get their pain medication.
Exactly.
Why is this a problem? I may be stating, it may sound obvious, but tell me about the implications of this.
Well, it's a problem because people have been used to getting these opioid medications. One issue is that many of these patients are on very, very high doses, far beyond the CDC guidelines, far beyond the Washington State guidelines, and they were allowed to be taking these doses through Dr. Lee's clinics. And so all of a sudden, they're not able to find pain providers. And so many of them can go into withdrawal and have very distressing symptoms. We haven't heard of any deaths or other terrible adverse events, but I know that I'm hearing from patients every week who are distressed because they can't get pain medications.
Why emergency rooms? What happens when these patients go to different pain clinics to try to get new prescriptions?
Well, one of the problems is that these patients are being referred back to their primary care providers to get help, and many of them may not either still be in contact with their primary care providers or they may not have one at all. And so they are going to the emergency rooms. You know, all of the medical professionals are encouraging them to go to primary care providers, but many of them are turning to the ERs.
Well, even if the patients have primary care providers or whatever clinics they're going to, what are they told in general when they try to get new prescriptions?
You know, prescription of opiates can be very complicated, and many primary care providers simply don't want to do it. They don't want to manage patients who can be difficult. They can be risky, and many primary care providers just simply say they won't handle it. That, in fact, is probably one of the reasons that the Seattle Pain Centers got into the situation it got in. I mean, Dr. Lee has said in depositions that he served, the clients that no one else wanted. And in some cases, that does appear to be the situation.
Well, what's the biggest concern? That these patients are addicted? That these patients may not have actual chronic pain issues?
You know, some of the patients may be addicts. Many of the patients, I'm told, have legitimate pain issues. They have longstanding injuries. They have other chronic conditions that require pain management. Experts at the University of Washington tell me that these patients can be handled successfully, that they need people who will treat them compassionately and help them find the best dosage, even if that means scaling back from where they are now. But that's very scary for patients and can be very scary for their doctors as well.
Yes, so let's say a doctor doesn't want to get involved for all the reasons you gave, doesn't want to prescribe these painkillers. Then what? What options do patients have?
Well, that's why they're showing up in the emergency rooms. The State Department of Health has been encouraging, urging primary care providers across the state to step up and help with this crisis. They say it's their moral imperative, basically, to help out with these pain patients. But right now, what I'm hearing is many patients say they are going without and they are in agonizing pain.
Jonelle, what has surprised you the most as you've reported what's happening to these painkiller patients?
Well, I guess I'm surprised at the human misery. These are people who, you know, have had terrible chronic issues and feel like they're suddenly out in the cold. You know, it is distressing. I mean, on the one hand, when you look at what happened to the patients that Dr. Lee is accused of not monitoring properly, those are terrible stories, and they're detailed in the statement of charges. And you can't just put people on these powerful opiates and then not take care of them. But on the other hand, there are all of these patients who now are left, you know, with minimal care. So it's a very difficult situation.
Jonelle Alicia is the health reporter for the Seattle Times. We're tweeting out a link to her story about the sudden shutdown of the Seattle Pain Center and how that is affecting the center's patients and doctors in this region. Join us on Twitter now, at KUOW. There are more than 100 islands in the Puget Sound area, but there is something on McNeil Island that makes it different.
The island itself is fairly picturesque. There's all kinds of small wildlife that live out there because there's no predators at this point and very little human impact. When you ask me what McNeil Island is, that's, yeah. I don't know if you meant the island or if you meant the facility.
Well, I'm wondering if this is just a slip of the tongue, but you said there were no predators out there.
That's public defender Andrew Morrison talking with Jeff Emptman of the local podcast Here Be Monsters. The facility they're talking about is the Special Commitment Center, where the state of Washington sends and holds people who are diagnosed as sexually violent predators. Now, the Special Commitment Center on McNeil Island is not a prison, but the people who are sent there are often kept there for life. Emptman and his co-producer, Bethany Denton, devoted a recent episode of Here Be Monsters to the Special Commitment Center. Earlier this year, I asked them how the state of Washington can legally hold people there, even people found guilty of committing terrible crimes, when there's no prison sentence involved. We'll hear from Bethany first.
So the legal justification is that civil commitment is intended to be rehabilitative and not punitive. And that means that because of the Special Commitment Center, for instance, offers treatment, it does not violate double jeopardy, which means that it's not strictly a punishment, a continued punishment for someone who has already served time.
There have been a lot of Supreme Court cases. SCC residents themselves have challenged this all the way to Supreme Court. One was claiming inadequate treatment, but again, it was dismissed because treatment was being offered, regardless of how sparse that treatment was.
Let's meet somebody in this situation. A character in your story is Chris, and for years he was defined as a sexually violent predator. And on the podcast, you withheld his last name for his protection and his family's protection. He was ultimately released from the facility on McNeil Island after his trial. Why were you drawn to Chris's story?
What I particularly found really fascinating about Chris is that he was sent to the Special Commitment Center when he was 18 years old. He had been convicted and served a 2-year sentence as a juvenile in a juvenile facility, but then was sent subsequently to the SCC on McNeil Island, the Special Commitment Center. And so, you know, now he's 36. This is a person who has never used the internet, never used a cell phone. He never had a job. In a lot of ways, he's 36 going on 19. And so this is a person who is about to embark on adulthood for the first time really ever in his life. He in a lot of ways is a stunted adolescent. And so part of the story was just interesting in and of itself.
Now, you know, Chris is he did the crime, right? He's mm-hmm. classified as a sexually violent predator. He's hurt a lot of people. He admitted to sexually assaulting his sisters and many other people. And he was ultimately released after his trial. One of the central questions of your story is whether or not people can change after doing something reprehensible. So what kind of answers did you come across?
You know, this is a topic that just has so many different perspectives on it. When I was originally thinking about what kind of questions we could ask about this topic, I assumed there were just these two perspectives. One is that we're just kind of these old babies that are walking around with layers of ways to cope with the different stressors that exist in the world.
Meaning those coping ways are not going to change? They're fixed?
Well, the coping ways would change, but the fundamental deviances that we have, the fundamental insecurities that we have are the same. The other perspective that I ran across, or I thought existed, were that humans are just entirely fluid all throughout our lives, and that we're just constantly shifting and reinventing ourselves. And throughout the course of reporting this, I came to realize that this isn't the only two options there are. Of course, there are many ways to view the ways in which people change. But the two main people that we talked to, one was a public defender named Andrew Morrison. The second was the head of the Sexually Violent Predators Unit at King County Prosecutors named Jennifer Ritchie. And the two of them had very differing perspectives on Chris. They had very differing perspectives on criminal justice, and they had very differing perspectives on that question of how do people change throughout their lives, or do they? So when we talked to the prosecutor in interview, Jennifer Ritchie, she told us, you know, people can change. People do change. She just didn't think that Chris did.
In our experience, because of his lack of treatment and because of our experience in seeing his history. You know, I'm not going to say we should be afraid of Christopher, because I'm certainly not going to, you know, fearmonger about Christopher, but it is keeping our fingers crossed. I mean, I hope to God to never see Christopher again, because if I see Christopher again, it means that Christopher is taking part in activities that are highly, highly risky behaviors.
And the public defender, Andrew Morrison, when we talked to him in interview, he kind of thought this whole idea of sorting things out into this dichotomy, he thought that was kind of a bogus way of approaching things. And what he told us instead is, he said, people respond to their environment. And he thinks that instead of locking people up on this island, we're going to have better results if we invest this money that we're spending on people in their communities and into individual people instead.
I think that, you know, in terms of becoming healthy people, what it's really about is learning ways to cope successfully without hurting other people. Human beings are social creatures. There is no one that is an island unto themselves that is better off isolated, who functions better that way. And the further we get away from that, the more unhealthy and the more dangerous we become.
As far as long-term recidivism goes, we just have a couple studies to look at here. And there's a big one that followed a large set of sex offenders that were all released in the year 1994, and it's kind of followed them ever since. And what that study found was that sex offenders as a whole are much less likely than other kinds of criminals to reoffend. That also has to be understood through the filter of knowing that, as Jennifer Ritchie rightly points out, that sex offenses are underreported. So it's kind of this confusing area where you can't take a statistic and apply it to a single person, especially a person as unique as Christopher, in that he only offended as a child. And there's some evidence. Again, I don't think Beth or I are the right people to comment on its scientific validity, but there is data that suggests that juvenile only sex offenders are completely different than their adult counterparts. So as far as like this question that I think a lot of people ask when they listen to this piece, is Chris going to reoffend again? It's a hard question to answer with data, but you can kind of get these little glimpses of the truth. Predicting the future is a dangerous game, especially when it's specific, especially when it's about a person. But that's essentially what the jury was asked to do.
Jeff Emptman and Bethany Denton are Seattle-based producers of the podcast Here Be Monsters from KCRW's Independent Producer Project. We are tweeting out a link to photos from their story on McNeil Island and the full podcast right now. Join us on Twitter at KUOW. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. The Washington Department of Ecology says the fastest erosion on the West Coast is happening at the aptly named Washaway Beach between the southwest Washington towns of Grayland and Tokeland. Coastal erosion threatens not just homes and a vital highway, but now the multi-million dollar cranberry industry, too. Most places threatened by erosion try to fight back. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports the erosion at Washaway Beach is so rapid, to retreat or fight is in question.
First, the ocean took a clam cannery. Then a lighthouse, a Coast Guard station, and homes slipped into the waves. Then the ocean washed away the cove that gave the community of North Cove its name. The coastal erosion at this spot, unstoppable for decades. The school succumbed. Then the Grange Hall, a post office, and more homes. Now cranberry grower David Cottrell worries about his bogs. They begin slightly more than half a mile from the present shoreline.
Like New Orleans, when the water goes over the top of a dike that you've been looking at all your life, and it's never done before, it's just even hard to imagine the consequences. I don't know what's going to happen, but I know it's going to be a lot. It's going to be hundreds and hundreds of acres of land that gets flooded with salt water.
The Grayland, Washington area has long been one of the centers of cranberry production in the Northwest. Third-generation grower Cottrell says Native Americans harvested wild cranberries around here long before white settlers arrived.
This is something that's been here thousands of years, and if it's lost, it's not coming back.
A rerouted state highway serves as a dike and the last line of defense for the low-lying cranberry bogs. There's a thin strip of land dotted with homes on the other side that's shrinking as the tidal channel at the entrance to Willapape migrates north. Winter storms combined with tidal forces chew off an average of 100 to 200 feet per year. Retiree Jim Northup has calculated how long before the rapid erosion reaches his place. He's a block and a half removed from where other homes now teeter on the brink.
I figure my cabin has got between 3 and 5 years. And in December, I'll be 81 years old, and so I don't know which one's going first, and it don't make much difference. I'm not worried about it, so that's it.
You have a really good attitude about this.
Well, what can you do? And they're not going to, nobody's, who's going to help this?
Pacific County, Washington Commissioner Lisa Ayers has observed reactions like that and more. Everything from hopelessness and doom to people full of fight. Ayers voiced determination to take on Mother Nature after listening to a new assessment from a consultant hired by the county. The coastal engineer reported the tidal channel is now holding steady just inland from Washaway Beach.
With enough money, you can do just about anything. So if we get our package together, a good product, and take it where we need to take it, we may be able to get some help with that. But at least it's not where I felt before. It was almost impossible to do a whole lot. I mean, it looks like there is some attainability for some of it, and that does make me more hopeful.
The cranberry growers want to fight back, too. So the local conservation district this fall will dig a trench at the foot of an old dike and dump in tons of rock to create a buried revetment. That means there'll be an armored shoreline in place when and if the waves come. David Cottrell calls it a welcome Band-Aid.
One may not be able to win, but we can play to stalemate is what I'm seeing right now.
The Washington State Department of Transportation is drawing up plans to reinforce the Seoul Highway along this stretch of coast with more armored rock. A sand berm out in the bay, paid for by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to protect the Shoalwater Bay Indian Reservation, is holding up. Still, tribal leaders have resolved to move uphill over the long term. Unlike people and homes, though, cranberry bogs can't be moved. I'm Tom Bonsi at Washaway Beach on the Washington coast.
This is The Record on KUOW in Seattle. Listen to this story. The leader of North Korea, a lover of movies, kidnaps his favorite South Korean actress and her director husband and forces them to make films, including a North Korean version of Godzilla. The couple stages a daring escape during a film festival in Vienna. They smuggle out some of the only existing recordings of the dictator's voice, and they find their way to Hollywood. You will hear the true story this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Thanks for tuning in today to KUOW's The Record. Boeing just got a global trade victory. For a dozen years, Boeing and the U.S. government have complained about billions of dollars in subsidies that Airbus gets from the European Union. Well, now the World Trade Organization agrees. Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton tells us a WTO compliance panel found Airbus and the EU are not in compliance.
This has real meaning in that it would give the United States the authority to impose billions of dollars in sanctions against the European Union goods and services if it chose to do so.
Will the U.S. seek these billions of dollars in retaliatory tariffs, and how would that affect Boeing?
It probably won't, and if it did, it wouldn't do much to affect the well-being of aerospace workers in Washington State or the United States.
Why wouldn't the U.S. go after the big sanctions?
Well, right now there is holding NATO together in the face of a resurgent Russia. There's the refugee crisis. There's the crisis in Turkey and trying to hold Turkey as part of Europe. There's Brexit and how that would affect a potentially fragile European Union. And so it's doubtful geopolitically that the United States would then say, okay, we're going to impose these sanctions. And then on top of that, the sanctions would end up costing American customers who bought European products.
But isn't the idea that the tariffs make Airbus planes more expensive, thus American Airlines buy more Boeing planes, and that's good for Boeing workers?
Well, the problem is that Airbus has established itself in Alabama with the assembly in Mobile, and it now has two Alabama senators, one of whom is holding up the Ex-Im Bank, which helps Boeing and thousands of other American companies overseas. And so the United States could not merely target Airbus. It would have to do a much broader set of sanctions.
Oh, intriguing. Okay, so on the other side of this, we've got to talk about what kind of subsidies Boeing gets from the United States and Washington State.
Well, this is the nut of the problem. Airbus has filed a smaller countercharge before the WTO against Boeing, and I think they specifically target the Dreamliner, which they call the subsidy liner. There is a difference between the two. In the case of the subsidies by Britain and Germany and France and I believe Spain for Airbus, they're in the form of launch loans to get these planes launched, and they're below commercial interest rates. And it's a very pernicious kind of, frankly, protectionist activity. In the case of Washington State, the Boeing has gotten handsome subsidies from the taxpayers, but these affect it as it builds the plane and goes off the assembly line and rolls out over many times. There's not a case where the United States or the federal government or the state government is giving Boeing billions of dollars to launch the Dreamliner or to launch the 777X.
I get the distinction, but what's the difference? Airbus gets cheap loans, Boeing gets taxpayer subsidies.
Well, you make a good point in arguing Airbus's case, and then this brings us back to, is the WTO, which is the crowning achievement of American foreign trade policy since World War II, really working?
Well, let's talk about that. Does this ruling bolster Donald Trump's case that American workers get shafted by global trade the way it's set up?
There is an argument to be made, and it resonates with many people, that American workers are getting shafted in world trade. But when you look at the evidence, there are probably more winners than losers among American workers. Americans buy more than they save, and that's another problem. That has nothing to do with subsidies or anything else. We haven't quite found a way to address the way China deals with trade. But when you look at the big picture, more Americans are winning from trade as it is than are losing. Now, having said that, there are a substantial number of people who are losers, and there are more people who are seeing their status and their livelihoods change, and they're looking for something to blame, and trade is a convenient target.
Finally, John, bottom line, it sounds like not much in the way of practical effect from this WTO ruling, unless you count the feeling of vindication.
You can call it a moral victory. Should you get a President Trump in November who took office in January, then the United States might well impose those sanctions, and it would be within the WTO to do so.
Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Bill.
You're listening to The Record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. So, are you going to watch tonight's presidential debate or listen on KUOW? You will hear it live here, 6 o'clock Seattle time. Will it be informative, maddening, and who has the advantage? Well, according to Iowa State political scientist David Anderson, Clinton has the disadvantage of high expectations.
She's not allowed to stumble. She's not allowed to pause and think about answers. There are just incredible expectations of how well she's going to perform.
We asked you on this show, what do you want the moderator, Lester Holt, to ask the candidates? Social media producer Bon Huberman, what do listeners want to hear?
Hey, Bill. Tamara suggests, he asks, 80% of Americans don't like either of you. What will you do tonight to get that up to 90%? Sandy writes, I'd like Donald to explain how a bill becomes a law. And Deirdre took us a little more seriously. She asks, what is your vision for keeping man-made global warming under 2 degrees Celsius over the long term?
Excellent. Deirdre, thank you. And Tamara and Sandy joining us on Twitter at KUOW. You can listen with all your fellow KUOW listeners tonight. We're carrying the presidential debate at 6 o'clock. Right afterward, back-to-back, the Washington State Governor's debate starts at 8. And you want to be at Naked City Brewery if you want to watch it with friends and a drink in your hand. That's going to start tonight at 6.